This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening. This is Inside Story with Sharmila Ganesan and Leechwe Lin. Tonight, we're talking about decriminalizing suicide now that it's finally moving forward.
First up, we talk about how changing the law will help and what else needs to be done to support it. And then we revisit what Nurul Izzah Anwar and Kasturi Pato have said on this as two MPs who have been advocates throughout. And finally, what kind of mental health care and support should be provided for people who have survived suicide attempts?
Tell us, how are you feeling about suicide being decriminalised? Call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is 6:07, and our show today is really based on this statement from yesterday's parliamentary sitting.
Kes bawah Seksyen 309 untuk mensabitkan mereka yang bunuh diri ini sebagai satu kesalahan memang telah lama dibincangkan dan proses pun telah berjalan dan saya telah dipahamkan setakat ini KDN dan Attorney General sudah bersetuju untuk memasukkan Seksyen 309 untuk sabit salah mereka yang bunuh diri ini. Peringkat sekarang ya untuk dibawa ke Kabinet dan seterusnya untuk membuat pindaan kepada Seksyen 309 supaya mereka yang bunuh diri ini atau cuba bunuh diri tidak akan disabit kesalahan lagi. Terima kasih.
So that was Deputy Health Minister Dato' Aaron Ago Dagang talking about how efforts to decriminalise suicide are moving forward and that the Home Ministry and Attorney General have both agreed to abolish the crime of attempted suicide under Section 309 of the Penal Code and that therefore the next step is to bring the matter to the Cabinet for deliberation before amendments are made.
So Aaron was actually responding to a question from Kemaman MP Che Alias Hamid on how decriminalising suicide could help reduce suicide attempts and what the government was doing to speed up this process, really. And currently, Section 309 of the Penal Code essentially states that unsuccessful suicide attempts could face charges and penalties amounting to imprisonment of up to a year, a fine, or both. And needless to say, this is something that keeps getting brought up as not really being a deterrent, not addressing the cause and the root of these problems, nor do they do much in terms of breaking the stigma or the taboo that surrounds the topic of suicide.
Yeah, so I think that the term that has come up quite a bit has been that it's cruel, right? That it fails to address, like you said, any number of things, whether it's actually working in terms of suicide prevention, whether it is addressing all these other causes. It also, I think, dampens conversations around it, which are so important. It increases this idea of stigma because now not only is there this issue with mental health or with, something that people already feel like it's very difficult to reach out on, then you're a criminal on top of that. So there is an element, I think, of cruelty and of not really understanding or meeting the needs of society that this law has always had an issue with, or this is the issue many people have had with the law, rather. And so the fact that it's going to be reviewed, I think, is very promising. But the other thing that we need to talk about, and it's something that we'll address with our first guest, is okay, great, if we're doing this, what other parts of the system are also going to have to change or adapt or step up in order to deal with this problem, which is something that we know is a growing concern, especially with the mental health struggles that many people have been going through because of the pandemic, because of the lockdowns, because of all the other things that come along with that.
Yes, because decriminalization, I think, is a very important step. But I would argue that it's the first step towards widening that conversation, looking at it from the point of empathy and support and care rather than as targeting or addressing it as something that we need to, in a way, I think I want to use this word as something to take care of or to resolve. It should be something that we look at in a holistic sense.
I want to say something else also, just briefly. I think that the issue perhaps is that we think that if we don't offer the stick, we must offer the carrot. But it doesn't, I think, have to be that way, right? Just because you remove a punitive element doesn't then mean that you have to kind of soften it or offer some sort of reward element. I think we are very trapped in that mindset of laws needing to work in this way, carrot or stick, as opposed to just breaking out of that very old paradigm and thinking of it in another form.
And that's actually what we will be discussing after this with our guest, Wenli Chan, who is an assistant professor with the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. But we'd like to hear from you. How are you feeling about suicide being decriminalised? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
It is 6:14. You're listening to the Evening Edition with Sharmila and Lynn. And today we are discussing the announcement that we heard yesterday on decriminalizing suicide. And, you know, we are on our way to seeing this happen, and we'd like to hear from you. How are you feeling about suicide being decriminalized? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We are shortly going to be crossing over to our guest to discuss why this is so significant and what the larger impact of this is going to be, but also what we should be looking at in terms of supporting this move and other initiatives that we should be putting into place. So keep your thoughts coming. We'll look at them shortly. And now on Zoom, we have with us Wenli Chan, Assistant Professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. Wenli, welcome to the show.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
So it was announced in Parliament yesterday that efforts to decriminalise suicide are underway. How do you feel about this?
Well, this news on the fact that efforts to decriminalize suicidal attempts underway was indeed very welcome news. And I would say this in my capacity as someone who has legal training, although not currently in active practice, a suicide prevention researcher, a person with lived experience of mental health conditions, and, well, a concerned member of the public. Well, to me, it's recognition at long last of the fact that, you know, persons who attempt to take their own lives need help, not punishment. And it's quite fitting too, I thought, that this news has come just a few days before World Mental Health Day, which is October 10th, this Sunday. Yeah.
So we've discussed this before across the station, but we still wanted to touch on it with you because it's an important point. What are the negative impacts of criminalizing suicide rather than approaching it as a mental health issue?
Yeah. So now laws that criminalize suicide attempts, such as the Section 309 of our Penal Code in Malaysia, it's a legacy of outdated colonial laws, you know, enacted in 1936 at a time when mental health and mental health issues were far less understood. We now know that suicide is a complex, multifactorial phenomenon, and it's in response to, you know, a combination of an individual's biopsychosocial circumstances. And with suicide attempts being seen as a criminal act, there are impacts on a few areas, I feel. Firstly, on the individual who attempted suicide. Now, it's extremely traumatizing, you can imagine, for a person who has been, you know, experiencing circumstances that has led them to attempt to end their life, to then be subjected to the additional adverse impact to their mental health of having to go through the criminal justice system, the process, to be treated as a criminal, when actually what they really need is help, right? Next, impact on people who are experiencing suicidal thoughts or mental health conditions and who need help. Now, such persons will actually be afraid to seek help for fear that it may have legal repercussions. You know, a fear that, for example, if they reveal to their doctor that they've been having suicidal thoughts, that they might be arrested. Okay, you know, even if in practice suicide attempts are not widely prosecuted, it remains a fact that people have been charged. So there's always that possibility, and people are that causes undue stress to people. They are afraid. They're already experiencing mental health issues, and they can't seek help. It also further adds to the stigma surrounding mental health. And if I may offer the perspective of a suicide prevention researcher, decriminalization will actually pave the way for better quality data, more accurate data on things like death by suicide, on suicide attempts, so that researchers like myself and my colleagues who research in this area, so that we can be better equipped to do studies on suicide prevention for better monitoring. And this is because deaths by suicide are not always properly classified because of stigma. Medical professionals may be reluctant to name suicide attempts, you know, to spare their patient of, you know, potential criminal charges or the worry of potential criminal charges. I could go on. I think it's clear that the time is ripe for for Section 309 to be repealed. Yeah.
So in practical terms, right, how would a change to the law affect the way suicide attempts are approached and treated?
Well, for one, it would definitely go a long way towards destigmatizing mental health issues, including suicide. And I feel it's a good start towards encouraging more conversations about suicide prevention, about being aware of the signs that a person may be suicidal and help them to seek help. And this can save lives. In terms of treatment, mental health professionals will continue to provide the relevant treatment and support that they always have provided to patients who have had suicide attempts. With the plus point that with decriminalization, our medical professionals can continue providing that treatment without the shadow of Section 309 looking at the back of their minds.
And I mean, you touched on this earlier a little bit. Decriminalization, I think, really can't happen in isolation, right? When we talk about something like suicide, it's complex, it's multifactorial. What sorts of changes do we need to complement and support this change in the law?
Well, this change in the law and us talking about this upcoming change is an excellent start itself towards raising awareness about mental health matters and about suicide prevention. And what we need to do, to continue to do, is to work on continuously raising awareness. And this needs to be done at many levels, from educating our children in schools, from advocacy within our communities, to, of course, efforts at state and national levels. There also needs to be ongoing training of frontliners and gatekeepers, i.e. people who are likely to come across persons who may have suicidal behavior. And we need to keep building on and training the people who man our support lines, our crisis helplines, for example. And in the area of suicide prevention, I should also add that postvention support is important. And this is to support and facilitate the healing of persons who may have been bereaved by suicide, friends and family, because bereaved persons may be at risk of suicide themselves. Yeah.
Are there laws that could perhaps play a supportive role rather than a punitive one?
Yes, certainly. In fact, in Malaysia, in the case of, for example, persons who are unable to seek help for their mental health conditions on their own, the Mental Health Act of 2001 empowers social workers, family members, or the police to bring in a person to a psychiatric hospital to get help, to get a medical examination done, if the situation is such that this needs to be done in the interest of that person's own health and safety, if the person is in a situation where they are at a risk to themselves or the people around them.
So I feel like I am bringing this up again, but when it comes to having a multidisciplinary approach to this issue, right, why is it important? And specifically within the Malaysian context, who are the stakeholders who need to be involved?
Yeah, to borrow a quote from one of my co-researchers, suicide prevention is everyone's business. And I'll elaborate more in a bit. We all have a role to play. So suicide prevention isn't just the domain of medical professionals. I'm not a medical professional myself. I'm not a mental health professional. I have a law and MBA background. I work at a business school. But basically, suicide prevention goes beyond conventional medical treatment of mental disorders. It involves things like we need to look at societal and organizational systems and actors within them that support conditions for the best possible development of individuals' mental health from a young age, yeah, while at the same time providing support to vulnerable members of the population who would be from of all ages as well. We need to look at, we are referring to also legal and regulatory systems that support, we're talking about a change, a potential change in one aspect of the legal system at the moment. But other than that, regulatory systems that support prevention strategies such as the restriction of access to means of suicide, that allow resources to be allocated to train members of the community who are not healthcare professionals on how to identify and manage suicidal behavior. So the more awareness and the more laypersons are equipped to, you know, identify, you know, whether signs and signs that someone may be suicidal, the better equipped we will be to handle the issue. And you were mentioning, yeah, in the Malaysian context, and in fact, you know, society and culture play a large role in determining how people view issues surrounding mental health, surrounding suicide. It influences the way people define what is mental health. It influences their ability to access help, treatment, their views towards help and treatment. It also influences, I think, the quality of interactions between healthcare providers and patients. And following from that, also how people respond to intervention and treatment. So yeah, it is more than just the domain of mental health practitioners, of the medical fraternity. And that's just an idea of, you know, some of the many stakeholders that are involved. Yeah.
Wenli, I wanted to follow up on something you said just then, which was about having a system that actually creates healthy, good mental health, right? Essentially, from a younger age. What would that look like? I think that, just thinking about what we have now and the gaps that exist for us as young adults and adults, I don't know. I mean, it sounds like such a great and wonderful thing to have, but I'm just wondering how we would have that in place.
I think it is... one example comes to mind, and that is, you know, we've been working from home or attending school from home during the pandemic at the moment, and got a young child at home, and so do many of my friends and colleagues. And when the child is, you know, taking their classes from home, they are told about the technological requirements of, attending an online class. And after a while, we sort of realized that ergonomics is important as well, because we're sitting in front of a computer at all times. But it is hardly spoken about, the fact that there are mental health aspects of isolation. We hardly talk about, the fact that you may be physically separated, but you should not, social distancing should not be, it's physical distancing, all right? You should not be, you should still be in contact with friends, etc. So I guess what I'm getting at is, I think for starters, there should be a lot more transparent conversations, and to start that at, primary school. My daughter is in primary school, and I do speak to her about what I do as a researcher. I tell her what is meant by mental health. Students may have an idea of what mental health is because that term does appear in school curricula, but what that means, and related to how we refer to people with mental health issues, how we deal with persons with mental health issues. So I think it may sound like a lofty idea, but I think this can be easily started off by just having more conversations. And I recognize also that has its own potential barriers, because that depends on, as a parent or a teacher, what that parent or that teacher's own perspectives about mental health matters are. It's education is important. Education at all levels.
Wenli, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Wen Li Chan, assistant professor at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia, and a suicide prevention researcher. We've been talking about decriminalising suicide, the significance and impact of that move, as well as further initiatives that we need to be looking at. If you'd like to speak to someone, some numbers to call, Befrienders, 0376-2729. You can also email them at sam@befrienders.org.my. We'll also have other numbers available on our podcast with this show. We're also asking you, how are you feeling about suicide being decriminalised? You can call 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. That number again for Befrienders, 0376272929, and the email is sam@befrienders.org.my. Coming up after this, we'll look at people who have been advocating for suicide to be decriminalised. So keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Bombing frustrated minds. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:37. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn. And today we're talking about decriminalising suicide and the fact that it's actually moving forward and is under review. And this is something, of course, that has been called for by civil society and NGOs for quite a while now. So some welcome news, really. And we've been asking you for your thoughts. How are you feeling about suicide being decriminalised? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Before we get to our next discussion, we have some messages.
So we have this anonymous message that says the repeal of the law is one part. Maybe it's at the end of the road of someone who had a failed attempt. We all know that prevention is better than cure. So to create and maintain a society that isn't over-competitive, that doesn't start a child's life with a paper chase to earn a living and then to face even more stress to survive in the keeping of their jobs or moving up the career ladder should be the objective. We have to admit it's materialism that causes a lot of our misery. Those of us who aren't strong or as strong or aggressive get left behind, sometimes even belittled. Maybe we have to check our capitalistic approach to life.
Well, there's a lot there, right? And I think that overall, I think it's this notion of just creating a more supportive environment for everyone, of all kinds of people, who might approach life differently, who might think about things differently, and not expect all of us to fit into one particular mold that we've held up for so long.
So I think for me, this comes back to, for example, our education system, because this is, just as an example, the ways in which we focus on examinations, the ways in which we focus on only a very narrow version of who is considered successful and who is considered filled with potential and who is not. I do think that aside from acknowledging that mental health sometimes is truly a health issue. It has, while of course the external factors are important, we also need to think of it in some instances as a medical issue, right? As something that is within our brain, our chemistry. Beyond that, I think how it is that we approach life and all the people that we encounter and the rubbing up of different value systems that the anonymous message is talking about, I think are, perfectly valid points.
Just very quickly, Munif says, decriminalising suicide, only two things to say really, about freaking time, what took so long even. And really on that note, I think is the perfect time to look at the people and the journey that has brought us here, because our colleagues on the station have spoken to a few MPs before about decriminalising suicide. We thought we'd look back on those conversations, but do keep sending your thoughts our way. How are you feeling about suicide being decriminalised? You can call 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. So Kasturi Bhatto, Member of Parliament for Batu Kawan, is one person who has spoken up about this before. She spoke to The Bigger Picture, and in their conversation, she relayed her insights when it comes to dealing with enforcement agencies who still have to take action after an attempted suicide.
We had a discussion with the police officers in our district office meeting, where we have different government agencies coming together. And it was just after I received some statistics on attempted suicides and those who have committed suicides in Penang. I asked the CPO of Penang to give me this data in a bit more detail, like according to gender, according to those who attempted and were saved, and those who had attempted and who had passed on. The numbers that of attempted suicides and who were saved and suicides alone was shocking. And these are the ones that was given by CPO. My concern, of course, is always the ones that never made it to the police station, the ones that we don't know of, the unreported cases. But the view that I received from the police, and it wasn't that surprising also, is that yes, when we questioned them and I questioned the officer, you know, will there be kertas siasatan that's going to be opened against those who survive? And he said, well, yes, you know, because some of the reasons of committing suicide are, you know, jilted lovers lah, and rejected cases lah, and things like that, which trivialized the whole the link between suicide and mental health, you know. But their viewpoint was also quite interesting. They said that it was in view of people who were attempting to commit suicide to run away or escape from a crime. For example, if you are carrying some items or illegal items with you, and then you had been, you know, you were stopped at a roadblock, you know, the easiest, if you're on the bridge, the easiest thing would be to just get out of your vehicle and jump over the, you know, over the bridge.
And this was the view of the enforcement officer.
Yes, yes. The first point he raised was that they were attempting to escape from a scene of a crime or from committing a crime. And he also further shared that there was a man who attempted to commit suicide outside one of the IPDs in Penang because he was unhappy with the way the police handled his case. I don't know what case it was, but so he said in cases like that, yes, kita akan buka kertas siasatan bagi pada DPP, biar DPP tentukan. I say, but at a time like this, you know, when most of the reasons I like to think are related to COVID, depression, mental health, you know, it's a multi-pronged effect, you know, and impact. I said, you know, is this something that you still do, or do you have discretion? He said, no, we still have to buka kertas siasatan, which then criminalizes the act, you know, and I'm sure all of y'all have touched on it and have spoken about this before. People who attempt to commit suicide want the pain to end. They don't want to end their lives, you know. They just want the pain to end, but they have no other way and they take this only way out.
Kasturi also commented on why she thinks it's taken this long for policymakers to push through with amendments on decriminalizing suicide.
I think that there's more of a conversation now to decriminalize suicide on social media and a great deal of outreach to people to pressure their elected reps to talk about it, raise it in parliament. And mass emails have been sent to us by Malaysians across the board. Many of the MPs have been receiving emails virtually on a daily basis or weekly basis of someone telling us, please push for suicide to be decriminalized and for a moratorium on investigations into those who have investigation papers opened. But I wouldn't know if it's too far-fetched to say this. The approach that the government has often is very conservative when it comes to this kind of a subject. It is perhaps the idea of if you decriminalize it, then more people will want to commit suicide. It could be funny, but honestly, there was a time that I proposed a special fund by the government to help B40 women financially if they wanted to come out of an abusive marriage, because divorce takes a lot of money and the paperwork is heavy, etc. And the reply that I got was, if we set up such a fund for these women, then we will encourage more women to get divorced, which I thought was just fuzzy logic. I couldn't understand. I said, these are women trapped in a marriage. They just don't have the money to pay for, to take the matter to court and get a proper divorce. You know? So they just live separately. But I think it's also about talking about sex education. You know, often the view is if you teach sex education in detail, then you will encourage young people to have sex. It's very primitive. It's very conservative. And I fear if this is the viewpoint of the Attorney General's chambers or even officers who are advising or those in you know, certain positions who feel that if you decriminalize suicide, then you allow more people to you know, you are sort of telling them, it's okay, you know, if you want to do it, don't worry, you won't be charged.
That was Batu Kawan MP Kasturi Pato speaking to T. Xiao Ik from The Bigger Picture. For the full podcast, look up When Will Malaysia Decriminalize Suicide on the BFM app or on bfm.my.
So Pematang Power MP Nurul Izzah Anwar was also on the station to talk about strengthening mental health policies. And she talked about how criminalizing suicide hasn't been helpful in reducing the number of attempted suicides.
We can see it from the numbers perspective, or we can just understand that it's affecting real people. You look at the news covered by Malay Mail, there was a man, he was unemployed, he had, you know, he was undergoing some family issues, and he was fined 3,000 ringgit for attempting suicide. I mean, it's wonderful that he managed to survive, but with that kind of onslaught, it only added further pressure. And you see that the numbers, even though Malaysia's suicide rates are relatively lower than other countries, the number of those who attempt suicide are increasing year by year. So it means that criminalization of suicide doesn't make a positive difference on the people attempting it. So I think it's important to be evidence-based in our policymaking, as well as, you know, compassionate and empathetic. And the fact is, suicide, if you attempt it, will carry up to 1 year in prison or a fine or both, right? That's the reality. While I'm happier that the discussion is percolating in a far more rigorous manner in comparison to 06, 08, before I became an MP. But, you know, even then, I have to admit, you know, it wasn't the main issue in everyone's minds. But now, how can you avoid it? You hear the cries, you feel the grief, you have to bring it up, right? Regardless of your partisan stripes. And you see that the close linkage in terms of their income levels with the state of mental well-being. So it really is important to understand the link between suicide and financial issue. It's a really, really kind of deep link. It should push governments to understand the importance of laws or you know, reforming at every level and providing sufficient social safety nets to protect the people.
That was a clip of Nurul Izzah Anwar, Pematang Power MP, on The Breakfast Grill. For that interview, you can look up future-proof mental health care policies. We are, of course, speaking about this in light of something the Deputy Health Minister shared yesterday in Parliament, that we are now on our way to decriminalising suicide. On that note, we'd like to hear from you. How are you feeling about this? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Coming up after this, we'll look at the care and support that needs to be given to those who have attempted suicide. So keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 6:50. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn. And today we've been discussing the decriminalisation of suicide here in Malaysia. That was brought up yesterday in Parliament. So we're on our way. And so we thought we'd close off this conversation by discussing the types of support and care that someone may need after a suicide attempt. We'd like to hear from you. How are you feeling about suicide being decriminalised? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We're now joined by Associate Professor Dr. Anasuya Jagadevi Jagadeesan, Director for the Centre of Human Development and Excellence at Taylor's University. Dr. Anasuya, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me again. And I am most happy that that we are decriminalising suicide. Seriously happy about that.
What are some of the main types of support and care that someone might need after surviving an attempt at self-harm or suicide?
Okay, the first thing they don't need is judgment. We have this very nasty tendency to want to know what was the cause, what was the straw that broke the camel's back. It's not about the straw that broke the camel's back. It's about the weight that's already on the camel's back. It's the other issues that has been in that person's life. It's how overwhelmed that person is. So the first thing is curb your curiosity. Give the person space. One of the biggest things they need at that point in time is a non-judgmental attitude and space for them to express themselves, to be heard, to feel that people want them to be alive, that people are grateful that they're alive, that people are welcoming them, that they're connecting with people. that is sometimes the best thing that we can give somebody who, you know, who has made an attempt on their life.
And is it crucial that someone who survives this attempt gets professional help, in your view?
In my view, yes. But you know, that there's lots of circumstances, there's lots of situations that may stop people from getting help. But in my view, it is crucial because it gives people the support that they need to look at different matters, to actually look at the layers of the problems and the situations they are in, so they themselves maybe have better insight on the situation and can approach the situation from a different manner.
How would professional support differ from that offered by a friend or a family member? But also, how do these different forms of support tie in together?
Okay. Friends and family are there for the, you know, to give love and to be there for them. But sometimes friends and family are also cause of pain. Sometimes friends and family are also cause of judgment. Sometimes friends and family are the reason that people feel they've got no choice but to attempt suicide. So when you're talking about professional help, what you get is what you're supposed to get. And if you don't get it from the counselor or the clinical psychologist or the person that you're dealing with, is unconditional positive regard. They are supposed to see you as a human being and deal with you as a human being and not as a problem, or you know, you are not, you know, or the source of the problem. They're supposed to give you a sense, an environment where you feel safe to share and to express yourself without expecting the other person to share their burdens with you. So one of the things that you get from a professional is that when I share my burdens with you, I feel confident that you can manage my emotions without needing anything from me, except, you know, the payment that you make or whatever arrangements that you have. And that's enough. You don't have the expectation that the counselor then will later on ask you for a favor or will use what you say against you or will turn up in an embarrassing situation and say it wrongly, or you know, or the biggest one is use those things against you. Confidentiality is one of the biggest things that professionals give you. And also techniques and methods of managing the situation that you may not have thought about. How to help you overcome the situation using different tools and techniques that you can use in your life so that you can get control of the areas in your life that have, you know, that have kind of overwhelmed you or have gotten you down too much. So these are things that professionals can provide.
So I would imagine that it's common for friends and family to possibly be overprotective after, right? Not wanting to leave you alone, not wanting to give you, you know, space. How can loved ones provide care while also respecting boundaries?
Like I said just now, one of the first things is don't play the blame game. Don't make the person feel like they're a baby and they have, you know, they have disappointed you so bad, so they have to watch you because, you know, you're stupid. You're not. No, that's not what people who attempt suicide are about. People who attempt suicide are desperate. You know, they're trying to reach out. Sometimes it's an attempt to relieve pain. They're in pain. And when you create a situation, you know, where you're going to give them more pain, then, you know, it's counterproductive. So, yes, people are going to war. I mean, I can't blame families for wanting to have an eye out. But when you have that eye out, don't forget to be kind. Don't forget to be compassionate. And don't forget that, okay, there has to be some space. You know, you have to have a safe space where, okay, when the person goes inside the space, leave them alone. Give them that space to think, to manage their problems, and give them an invitation to reach out to you. Be open about that.
Now, when offering that support to a person who has attempted suicide or struggles with self-harm, what are some of the possible reactions that we could expect from them, and how can we manage that?
That is a very wide question, because you can have every kind of reaction, from rejection of what you are talking or very honest. And when people are very honest, sometimes you may not be ready to hear it. One thing about when you are trying to speak to your family and family members, remember, we have all relationships, and sometimes they're talking about what you have done. And then the reaction is, are you blaming me? No, we are not. The person is not blaming you. The person is informing you of what is causing them pain. But because you are part of that story, then you feel that it's a blame game. So this is where family becomes very complicated. This is where you know, if you are entering into that discussion, you know, the tagline, stay calm, for goodness sake, stay calm, stay kind. Do not go, you know, do not get into this thing of somebody must be for blame. Sometimes the person is sharing a story just to tell you this happens. Acknowledge it happened. It's over, it's in the past, but just acknowledge it and then say, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I didn't see things from that perspective. I'm really sorry that happened. And move forward. Now, what can we do about it now? Sometimes that's all people need to hear. They need to hear that they are heard and they acknowledge that their perspective is valid. And, you know, they're not trying to blame you, but okay, at that point in time, I didn't know any better. I'm so sorry. Now, what can we do about it now? That's the key question. What can we do about it now? Bring it to the, you know, after you've acknowledged what happened. You know, but the guilt is a horrible thing and nobody likes guilt. But when people lash out in guilt, when you're feeling guilty and you're lashing out, that doesn't help anybody. So those are the things we watch out when we are family, that, you know, that we don't go down those lines. Just be supportive, be there, and get mediation. If you can't get professional help because, you know, don't have the resources or whatever, get, you know, people who are neutral to mediate between the conversation. Don't try to do it by yourselves because, you know, let's face it, if somebody is suicidal, then that conversation has broken down for a long time already. Don't suddenly expect because the person attempted suicide can suddenly make the conversation work. You need another element there to keep people calm at least. So if you're not going to get professional help, try to get mediators at that point in time. Did I actually answer the question?
Yes, yes, you did. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Dr. Anasuya.
My pleasure. And I'm really glad that the government is going through. I'm hoping, praying that it goes through really fast because I think this is a very good step forward.
Thank you. That was Associate Professor Dr. Anasuya Jagadevi Jagadesan, Director for the Centre of Human Development and Excellence at Taylor's University, weighing in on the sort of support and care that those who attempt suicide would need. If you'd like to speak to someone, you can contact Befrienders at 0376272929. You can also email them at sam@befrienders.org.my. We'll also have other numbers available on our podcast. We'd like to hear from you. How are you feeling about this news that suicide is being decriminalised? You can call 7733200, WhatsApp 0187898899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.